So we're here this week with Sean Ryan again to talk about this week the budget, which is kind of foremost in, I think, everybody's minds with this particular election. And what I want to understand before we actually get into your specific ideas about the budget and where you want to take it and the issues that we have, is I want to understand actually how a municipal budget works. So I'll tell you what I understand of it, and then you can tell me if I'm completely wrong, if I'm partly right or whatever, and sort of help educate us a bit.
Budgets are an empirical document. They're actually knowable.
They are knowable. But this is I'm talking about like the actual process of how they operate. And so the way I've kind of understood it is it's slightly different than how we would do a budget for our family or something like that. And since it's kind of projected out both on presumed income and then presumed expenses, there's certainly some of it that's fixed and then some of it's not. And so the criticism you hear about it in this is that an administration will overestimate potential revenue. So let's say they think that there's going to be so much income from X. And then there's other things that they're projecting in terms of expenses that can just go completely haywire. Like, let's say it's a huge snow year, there's a lot more snow expenses. You always hear about the overtime going way over, that they've underestimated on the overtime. And then what happens is we get to some point in the year where the money's gone, we're digging into cash reserves, or figuring out where to get more money or borrow more money. And the way I understand it now is that the problem is that there no longer are any cash reserves. So this is what's putting us in this kind of crunch now. So now I'll leave it. You can correct me or rebut me or...
No, that's just... about... So, all right. It's not different than your household budget or a business's budget. You know, you have to guess what you're going to spend, right? So you know what your mortgage is going to be, but you don't know what everything is going to be. So, you know, you put a number in, but it's going to be a fair number. And that's why you have a comptroller to check your numbers. And then revenues are the same way. You know a lot of what you have to spend. But this only really works if we're all in on the bit. And being in on it means we're all being honest. So if people aren't being honest and all the levels of government agree not to be honest, you end up with a budget that's out of whack, you know, every year. And that's what the city of Buffalo did. Every year they projected revenues that were unrealistic by anyone's assumption. They always included things, you know, big marijuana revenues before marijuana was even legalized, casino revenue when there was no thought you were ever going to get the casino revenue that year because the Seneca and the state were in the middle of a fight. Increased sales tax, even though everyone projected sales would be down. So that's how you can fake it on the revenue side. But on the expenditure side, you know, that's another place. If you're not committed, you know, to honest, transparent government, you know, you say we're going to, you know, run a police and fire department with very little overtime, even though every year before you had spent a lot more money and no changes had taken place. So, you know, you would call that just phony baloney, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what the city's done for the last few years. It's been fake budgets, gimmicky budgets. And then at the end of the year, they would always pull money in, you know, from the cash reserve. For a while, they were able to pull out of the federal government with ARPA. You know, a few times the state did come through with unanticipated revenue for them. But all those sort of looking under the couch cushion, look under your sock drawer, that money's all gone. The city of Buffalo's cash reserve is zero. You know, they passed a budget last year that underestimated expenses. We've already blown through more of the projected overtime by a quarter than we were supposed to. And then they also put some fake revenues in there, including, you know, the sale of a parking ramp, which may or may not happen. Even if you wanted it to happen, it might not happen. So what they always do at the end of the year is they'll really have to tighten your belt. And one way you tighten your belt is you stop replacing anyone who retires. So for a period of months, so you can control the last quarter, you know, spending. It's called vacancy reserve. But, you know, all the games are over. So, you know, I'm inheriting a government with there's no games to be played. So you got to have just straight up honest budgeting. you got to know what your expenses are, and you have to know what your revenues are going to be. And I'm going to put forward structurally balanced budgets that make sense.
So how do you, like, how does that actually work? Like, in practice, like, so you're, each department then submitting to the mayor's office, this is what our projected expenses are for the upcoming year, and then the mayor takes that and compiles it. So explain how that actually happens, sure. And then how you would change it.
This is how we do it in the state, and this is how we did it when I was at Erie County. You go to all the departments, and you tell them, tell me how much it's going to cost upcoming this year. And your budget director looks at it to make sure that's another set of eyes looking at it. And then the comptroller looks at it to make sure that's another set of eyes. Then it goes to the legislature, in this case, the city council, where they look at it, you know, for another set of eyes. This is with revenues and expenses. But the system is just broken down. So we're going to return to honest and open budgeting. The comptroller did, if you go through her documents, the comptroller did put up year after year warnings that these projections are wrong. But nobody listened, and nor did she trumpet them, you know, very loudly. So, you know, you got to trust government enough and the checks and balances. But you got to honor those checks and balances. You can't, like, cow your political enemies into, you know, all agreeing to fake numbers, because look what happens. Like, here we are, mm-hmm. right? A system we're busted. As, you know, if we were a company, we'd be out of business right now.
Yeah, and it is coming off of, and I guess when you look at this in retrospect, and coming off of several years of Buffalo feeling really good about itself, right, and lots of things happening in the city, you can see that, you know, the question is, was that happening at the expense of, you know, the way it looks now is that we're just kicking the can down the road to a point where now we're at a point where
there's no more road.
There's no, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But even those good years that were just a few years ago, and I'm confident we can recapture some of that energy, you know, that's when they should have made sure the revenues were square. And actually mm-hmm. increased revenues coming in from, you know, commercial development was really happening. But instead, the city gave every new building owner a 12-year tax abatement. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did, you know, if you used to add up the wrongs. But, you know, let me see if I can have you look at it this way, unless it takes you out of order, but sort of understand where our money comes from.
Yeah.
So 26% of our budget is from property tax revenues, commercial and residential. That's it, 26%. We get more in state aid than we get from our own property tax revenue. Buffalo gets more in state aid than any other upstate city. You know, we get almost 28% from state aid. Rochester gets 17%. So we got this extra state aid every year. But what we did in response to that is stop raising our taxes. So the state would give us more money. And instead of adding to it to make downtown better, you know, to make it so we can fund lead paint prevention programs, instead, we just started cutting our own revenues that we put in. So now you know, we're out of whack. So 26% comes from property, about 28% from the state, 18% from sales tax, and then another just under a quarter is from a mix of fees and parking meters. But, you know, we get more money, you know, than the state, from the state to anyone. Rochester gets 17% of their budget from the state. Syracuse gets 21%. Albany gets 5%. Buffalo gets 28%. Mm-hmm. And yet we're broke.
Mm-hmm. And so that leads me, so you did, I appreciate that, because you answered a question that I had about the sort of the breakdown of revenue. So honestly, I've been here, I moved to Buffalo in 92, and this has been essentially the same conversation since I've been here. Is it actually possible for Buffalo to get beyond this and actually have a balanced budget? And how do we do it?
Yes. Like, look, I mean, we're still rolling in this ethers of it's 1981, everything's bad, you just got to cut, 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 cut. And then you know, forever the Buffalo Niagara Partnership was the voice of austerity. And so for 30 some years, the last two mayors were all about the voice of austerity. But it was really making it so commercial property owners didn't have to pay taxes. Like, that was the whole deal. And then we didn't want to reassess our properties. You know, we had the last 20 years, just wild ups and downs of, you know, people in big, like what everyone would say would be a mansion, hadn't had their properties reappraised in 20 years. So, you know, we're good news is we're at 100% equalization. Every property in the city of Buffalo has been reappraised, but you know, we're a decade late on that. So, but at least we're in that pair. But yeah, you can have a balanced budget. You know, the Erie County has one every year. Amherst has one every year. West Seneca has it. Lackawanna does one every year. So all these governments do it. You just have to have the will to do it. And you have to be honest with people. And you have to put it forward of, you know, we're going to have to increase our property taxes, residential and commercial. And you got to bring it to the voters and say, it's up to you. You want us to increase these taxes? And with that, we can fill potholes and fix community centers. You know, get more programming and, you know, in our communities in downtown Buffalo and do youth sports, or do you want to leave it the same? So, but that's just an open conversation, you know, you could have with people, but, you know, we're so underwater. But to get out of this and get back on our feet, you know, JM, we're going to need like a 3-year get back on your feet plan. So we're going to have to make our efficiencies that we can within government. But then we're going to have to go to the state. We're going to have to ask for some help. You know, each year, less money. But by the end of year 3, with efficiencies, with some of the property tax abatements burning off that we gave to, you know, every new build in Buffalo is not paying taxes. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that money will start coming in. Property values keep going up. You know, we'll do gradual tax increases. We should be able to get back on our feet after 3 years. But you need an honest, transparent budget. Otherwise, people just shrug their shoulders and say, you know, why do I live in Buffalo? I don't, you know, what do I get out of this deal? Like, people say, you know, they moved to Kenmore because not only did they get their streets plowed, but there's a soccer program for their kid, a program, senior program for their grandmother, and the pool's open to swim in the summertime. You know, and the taxes just up the road in Tonawanda aren't really that much different than Buffalo's.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that leads me to one of my sort of things I had on page 2 of this, but it kind of ties into what you're saying, is I'm also curious about the amount of property that's simply off the tax rolls, like all of the land that's owned by the city, that's owned by other, let's say, you know, non-tax-paying entities, but particularly the city-owned property. And I think one of the challenges that Buffalo has is, like, you know, we hear all this talk, like, we need to do infill housing, we need to build all this stuff, which is all, like, it's all true, but how does it actually work? Do we have enough people coming here to fill that? How do we get enough people? And that would seem to be a way, if we could somehow figure out how to get more of the property that's not paying taxes into paying taxes,
sure,
that would also help balance this budget. But
yeah, so that pulls away two things, right? You know, some of the state money we get is supposed to offset the zoo, the art gallery, the hospitals. That's why we get, you know, this state money. We don't have that much. The percentage of our non-taxable, non-profit properties isn't that much different than Rochester and Syracuse. Albany is way out of whack because they have the whole state capital, yeah, there. So, you know, we can definitely, when we go to the state and ask for more money, one of the things we're going to talk about is, you know, Amherst has a higher tax base than we do. Mm-hmm. Well, part of the reason they have the higher tax base is because they don't have Roswell and Kaleida and ECMC, and they don't have the theater district and Klein Hands. So we should use that as an argument, you know, to get more. The property tax that we have control over, or land that could generate revenue, is, you know, we have 8,000 vacant lots, mm-hmm, plus industrial land that the, yep, city struck to itself. So that's why it's incumbent to get that land back in circulation. You know, 8,000 new homeowners is 8,000 new taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And makes it more efficient to drive that snowplow down the street if every lot has a house on it. So we have a lot of work to do. But we also have just about the same number of vacant lots are owned by private people. So we're going to have to come up with programs to get all this stuff back online. And, you know, we had mild growth. How much did we grow in the last decade? 20,000?
Yeah, I think it was about that.
Yeah, which is probably only 7,000 families. Mm-hmm. So, but just those 7,000 new folks put a big strain on our housing market. So we're projected to have continued growth, but we're not going to achieve that growth if we don't have places for people to live. I mean, houses don't stay on the market very long anymore. I mean, companies tell me that people that they're hiring and bringing in from out of town can't find a house in Buffalo. So we're going to have to put more houses on the market. You know, I maintain it was a better place for average Buffalonians before the property values went through the roof. Because everyone can afford to buy a house. Now the average house is going between 220 and 240. A whole lot of Buffalonians can no longer afford to buy a house.
Yeah, and I would say what, I mean, sort of my experience of this phenomenon is, of course, you know, kind of boots on the ground being in real estate. And, you know, my feeling is that Buffalo was so behind the game from years of non-investment, right, and flight from the city, that we were behind the building that needed to happen before we got into this sort of nationwide what's called a housing crisis, which
we're still knocking down,
and that was so we are in a situation now where I think that across the board, you know, there is a demand for primarily single-family housing.
Yep, singles and doubles.
And because that's what most people want to start out with here. And the other thing that has shifted in the last, you know, a positive change in Buffalo is that when I was here in the 90s, you know, if you were a doctor, professor, attorney, whatever, you were buying a house in East Amherst. That's just what you did. Right. And now a lot of those families are now buying a house in the Elmwood Village, right, or in the core of the city. And so that's increased the property values. It's increased the demand for what I would say is sort of market ready housing stock, the stuff that doesn't need to be, like, I bought a fixer upper because that's what you did when you bought a house in Buffalo in the 90s. You bought a dump.
Me too. So, I bought a dump.
And so, but those days are over, really, for most people. They want to buy something. They've got a job. They need to move in. The kids are starting school. So there is a demand.
But the dumps are gone.
Well, the dumps aren't totally gone.
Yeah, but you can't go buy a dump anymore for $30,000.
No, you cannot.
$40,000.
No, you're still spending a fair amount of money for it.
Yeah, so dumps aren't really achievable to a, you know, a firefighter who's 2 years on the force or a young teacher. You know, young person working, you know, for the city of Buffalo, those dumps aren't within their price range anymore.
No.
And it's almost the very lawyers and doctors you were talking about are the only ones now who could afford a dump.
Yeah. But it's, you know, the positive thing about that, you know, because what happens with a market is it alters other markets. So if the Elmwood Village becomes unaffordable for people, then it drives other markets. So you see markets like, you know, Riverside, Kaisertown, like, you know, I'm blown away by some of the prices in Kaisertown.
You first started seeing it north of Hurdle.
Yep. And
then you started seeing people, you know, going areas around Canisius where they wouldn't have gone before, mm-hmm. up to Black Rock. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people I know of, you know, the under 30 crowd have bought a house in South Buffalo the last few years.
Yep.
So that there's a... You're right, it pushes out, right? It used to be that one crescent the urban planners would look at it and say, here's stable Buffalo that generates all the tax revenues, but that's spread. But if you want to go back to tax revenues, you know, I said there's the other part of the budget, that 23% that comes from a lot of, you know, different sources. Yeah. You know, part of that is fines. Mm-hmm. So we have an active housing court. A lot of people don't keep up their properties. The housing court is only, on average, collects 9% of the fines per year that they issue. Only 9%. Over the last 6 years, that's $6.5 million of uncollected fines. The water board, since COVID, where they used ARPA money, federal money, to pay back a lot of people's water arrears, which was kind of odd. The city took federal money to pay people's water bills that went back to the city, so they kind of paid themselves. But since COVID, we're back up to $20 million in water arrears. So, you know, we have a lot of places in our budget that just doesn't depend on, oh, are you going to cut? Are you going to tax? You know, there's a lot of other places, you know, parking enforcement revenue. It's all over the place. It's not systemic like it used to be. I used to be, if my car was out from my house at 9:05, I was going to get a ticket. You know, I got one ticket in the last 4 years. I don't know how the city is actually, I know how they're budgeting these other revenues, but I know they're not going to get those other revenues, which is, you know, it's a lot of money. So we have a lot we can clean up in the city. It's not going to solve our problems, but, you know, I'll take the $20 million from water bills. I'll take the $8 million of old fines.
And so part of the reason I'm curious about that stuff is because, you know, I think, and it's not Buffalo. I think, you know, it's cities, states, all across the country use, you know, there's different methods of funding government, and fines and fees are one of them. I'm personally kind of opposed to a lot of it.
Water bills?
No, not water bills. Like, I'm not talking about paying your bills, but relying on, and I think some cities or places are actually are more reliant on it. It's because I think it does affect lower income people more.
Good. Well, if you ever looked at the distribution of where parking tickets are issued in Buffalo, it's not in lower income areas.
No, the parking tickets, I'm sure, the bulk of them, I'm sure, are downtown and Elmwood, yeah, and streets like that.
But a lot of this is just good practices. So in Rochester, you don't pay your water bill after a certain number of days, it gets added to your property tax bill, which is then lienable.
Right.
So when you eventually sell your house, we're going to get paid. But Buffalo doesn't do that. The water bill is just sort of set out there.
Well, if you sell a property, it is supposed to be, it's attached to the property. So if you actually sell it, and you are using above the board attorneys, they will, the water bill is reconciled. And if there's a back water bill, it will be that some of the proceeds from the sale will go to paying that water bill off, the back water bill. I encountered a property one time.
You know what they don't do?
They don't shut it off. So I went.
They shut it off. So now, if you look at the distribution map, who's not paying their water bill, it's all over wealthy areas of the city of Buffalo. Commercial properties stop paying their water bill. Oh, I'll deal with that at the time of sale.
Yeah.
But they're not paying their water bill on commercial buildings because they don't have a collection policy and they don't have a rational turnoff policy. So I don't know what they're thinking on some of these things.
Houses
in the fancier neighborhoods in Buffalo are not paying their water bills, and no one seems to ask them to pay their water bills.
Well, that I was going to bring up. I mean, this was several years ago now, but I was dealing with a property that was a two-family, and both units were occupied, and there was a $29,000 water bill, and I called the water department. I said, "How does a property like?" There's people living here. It's just a regular two-family home. How does a property have a $29,000 water bill? And they were like, "Well, there's got to be a huge leak." I was like, "There's no huge leak." But how is the water still on? So, and I couldn't, like, nobody had an answer for that.
Yeah, they still don't.
I mean, that to me, that's clear. And I think, you know, every now and then there is a large property owner that will make the news for not paying their taxes and not paying their water bills and some you know,
or not paying their housing court fines.
Yeah. And so these things do
They add up.
They add up, and they do accumulate.
Yeah, well, I mean, it does account for nearly a quarter of the city's entire budget.
So, back to the back to the core of the budget. I'm interested in what some of the very specific growing costs are that go up every year.
Health insurance is one. The city is really behind on negotiating health insurance. Like, the county moved over to a labor management health policy 20 years ago. Saves the county untold millions of dollars. City never went down that route at all. So we got to look at how we provide health care to the entire...
So explain that to me. So what's the difference between how the county is doing it and how Buffalo does it?
The county puts together a labor management committee, and they use all that buying power to go and try to negotiate the best policy for the money. And that's what you pay. The city is going on a loan without labor with them. So labor is not coming to the meetings where they tell you how much it's going to cost. So instead, the city has just been absorbing that cost, not trying to mitigate it to try to get a more competitive policy. And they're not bringing their workforce in as part of these conversations.
So healthcare, is there anything else that is kind of one of these lines that's going up?
Yeah, the city unwisely negotiated police and fire contracts that just have overtime built in. Like, you know, the contract calls for overtime. You know, manpower mandated. So if JM takes off on a Monday or gets sick on a Monday, the chief can't say, "Oh, you know, this is the slowest recorded day on history. We're not gonna do a replacement for JM." You got to bring somebody else in at 1.5 time and a half. And so that happens with a lot of regularity, without a lot of oversight to try to prevent people taking advantageous sick days. There is no process to try to tamp that down. So the contract lends itself that way, but management hasn't done anything to try to slow that down.
And right now... am I correct in saying that they're both working without contracts now, police and fire?
They're either without contract or soon to be without contract. So everyone's going to be out without contract next year. Police, fire, blue collar, white collar, sewer, white collar, sewer, blue collar. So we have a lot of contracts to negotiate this coming fiscal year.
There's
in the workforce, PS, they deserve to be paid.
Right.
You know, we have residency requirements in most of these jobs. So as housing values have gone up, our salaries haven't gone up. So, you know, it's going to be a real challenge for the city to get the next generation snowplow drivers, because a house on Lovejoy no longer costs $100,000.
Right.
But our salaries haven't kept up. And that's the thing with this sort of, you know, a 19-year freeze on taxes. You know, 19-year freeze on sewer charges. Those costs don't go away. You know, just keep pushing them down the road. But now we have to face them. But also during those 19 years, you know, it was hard to compensate the workforce the way they needed to be. So I'll give you an example. You know, you work for this city sewer department. And you have to have certain certifications to run certain pumps in certain parts of the sewer. If you have that certification, you know, you can just go online in Erie County and look up what their sewer operators get paid. And the person with that same certificate in the county is making $30,000 more than you. So as soon as that county worker, there's a posting, all the city workers apply to the county job because their salaries are so much higher. So you just can't get away with you know, cheaping out year after year after year without it catching up to you. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, for the city and for leadership is everything's come and due at the same time. So we have all these, you know, bills, you know, that are due, and we have all these contracts, you know, that are up, and inflation's going up, and our salaries haven't kept. So, you know, we have to really work together to come up with, you know, a plan. You know, and I plan to start taking trips to Albany not long after the election, but I'm going to go with the CSEA workers, with the AFSCME workers, you know, with the operating engineers, with the police officers, with the fire department, you know, to talk about this is what we need, the help we need to be able to invest in our workforce, you know, to attract a good workforce, but also to retain, you know, the current workforce. Years ago when the city switched to privatize recycle, the city garbage drivers made so much more than someone who drives a recycle truck. Right now, the recycle truck driver makes more than a city garbage truck driver does.
That's also, when you bring this up, the difference between the county and the city, it's always made me wonder in this region why there aren't more sort of consolidated services. If, you know, could there ever be something like, let's say, let's just pick one, a streets department that was Erie County and the city of Buffalo, it was all the same thing.
Could, I mean, I guess you could, but, you know, Kevin Gaughan, I was running around talking about that stuff forever, and a bunch of towns did a lot of those things, but they found their costs didn't go down. So you still need the same people power. Mm-hmm. You know, you still need the same number of engineers. The only advantage it gives you is it gives you a planning advantage.
Right.
But it doesn't really give you any cost advantages.
Okay. Well, the last question I'm going to ask you is, you know, I think I read up on my fire news, I follow the fire department, all this kind of stuff. That's my sort of interest. And one of the things that's been in the news nationally from Buffalo to Los Angeles is the poor quality of fire departments in terms of the fleets. So falling apart apparatus, it's been in the news in Buffalo. You know, there was it hit the news in Los Angeles after the fires earlier this year of how much apparatus was actually out of service. And it's really easy for everybody, because what they do is they point the finger at the mayor, or they point the finger at the fire department, the fire commissioners, and say, you guys aren't doing your job. But really, with more analysis, it's really what's happened is that there's nobody making fire engines anymore because they've all been bought up by private equity. And the cost of a fire engine for a city like Buffalo has more than doubled since 2020. And the wait times are now, you know, around 2 years.
That's a current problem, and I get it. But Buffalo's problem started well before the concentration of fire equipment makers. Our equipment is very, very, very old. And it's not just fire. Snowplows, ancient. Any given time during the winter, up to 30% of the snowplow fleet is in the shop because it's so old. So we have a very old, almost every piece of capital equipment you can think of in Buffalo is outdated, past its useful life. But we don't do smart things like, you know, we just brought in a fleet manager recently, but that was only in response to the loss of life in the winter storm. We haven't empowered that fleet manager, but a lot of cities our size, you know, they'll have all the cars they own, they'll be traded out every X months because they have a contract to renew them. Gets their maintenance costs down, but it makes their cars more reliable. But we don't have that program for a city cars. We don't have it for snowplows. I mean, the county has adopted these programs, you know, years ago. So you're always getting a renewal. You know, it's like any private company. They barely buy their fleet anymore.
Right.
They lease their fleet. Mm-hmm. Now Buffalo.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was my question. I mean, this is like, there's some of these things that are problems nationwide. So they're actually harder to fix. Like, you have to be really creative to figure out how to fix some of these things when they're not just Buffalo specific.
I'd say I get the nationwide trend, but that's not why our fire hydrants aren't pumping out
water at the right pressure. That's not why our snowplows are out of date. I mean, heck, we almost sunk the fireboat a couple years ago. You know, I came in with a $500,000 grant from the state to redo the hull because it was becoming weak and the city just kept sending it out to break ice. And the city's mentality was, well, if it sinks, we'll rescue you, but we'll go get a new boat after that. But instead, we reinvested, in the fireboat. And I know we're up against it with trying to replace equipment rapidly, but that scenario you were talking about, it's not for snowplows. But we're in the same place with snowplows, with our police department. We don't have a policy for when we, trade out new cars. But this is all like numbers, right? So you get different bids and you figure out what's going to be the cheapest. But right now, I just sense that there really isn't a lot of set programs. Here's our fleet replacement program.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Like what? Like the system itself has to change.
Well, you have to have one,
right? So yeah, you have to have a system, or you have to change it, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. But we're going to develop a system for things like fleet replacement. I visit a lot of Buffalo Fire houses, and it's just amazing the equipment they use. Yeah. I represent the suburbs too. Mm-hmm. And you go and look at Hamburg and Tonawanda's and Amherst equipment. It's all more updated than Buffalo. It's a crying shame that we put our firefighters in this peril by not having the most up-to-date equipment. A couple years ago, I came up with a grant. The fire department union works with Roswell really closely to check the health of their firefighters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had a really good novel program. They have a good novel program where they start doing baseline testing on new firefighters. And then one of the things they said we need is a new system. They call them extractors. They're washing machines, but they extract the carcinogens out of your turnout gear.
Right.
So everyone has to have two pieces of gear now, two outfits. But when you get done with a fire, you send your equipment down to the extractor and they put it through. So I got a grant to buy extractors for the city of Buffalo. The extractors, they weren't plugged in for well over a year because the city took that long to run electrical outlets to the extractors so they could be turned on. It's farcical, but you realize that you're putting people's lives at risk.
Yep.
I mean, firefighters don't know they have cancer from the job until after they retire. Mm-hmm. So, there's things, JM, that are just like they're as plain as a nose on your face. Mm-hmm. And those are the things we have to systematize and make programs out of. There are more complicated challenges, but a lot of the challenges are what I just described. Why did it take you so long to plug in your extractor that's going to save firefighters' lives?
I think that's a good note to end this on. So I appreciate the conversation again, Sean, and hope to see you back soon.
Well, I enjoyed our conversation, as I always do. Thanks so much for... You're really keeping a close eye on the mayor's race.